Good morning. This is James Stevenson in the NBC newsroom in New York, bringing you the news of the world and calling in NBC observers at the scenes of action overseas. First, a glance at the latest developments. Russian troops are within 150 miles of Berlin, as rumors, entirely unconfirmed, report that the Nazis are beginning to evacuate the German capital. Panic and hysteria are said to be sweeping through the Reich as Adolf Hitler rushes to the eastern battlefront to take personal command. On the western front, the German withdrawal from the Ardennes salient appears to have turned into a rout today. 3,000 German tanks and vehicles have been knocked out by Allied planes in concentrated mass attacks. The Luxembourg sector of the once dangerous German bulge is virtually free of Nazis, and those remaining are offering only disorganized resistance. On Luzon, General MacArthur's men are now 54 miles from Manila and within 11 miles of the great air base at Clark Field. And the War Department announces another B-29 attack in force on the Japanese home island of Honshu. Specific details have not been released, but the communique reports that industrial targets receive the full weight of destructive bombs dropped by superfortresses of the 21st Bomber Command. In the meantime, Admiral Nimitz has revealed that a major United States warship was damaged in Saturday's Third Fleet attack on Formosa. And now a few words from your announcer.
Perhaps you've heard recent talk about the possible length of the war with Japan. Well, if you haven't, here's what our top authorities in the War, Navy, and State Departments believe. They believe that the war with Japan will take a minimum of a year and a half, or 2 years, after the defeat of Germany. Now, here are a few of their reasons for their estimate. 1, Japan still holds her main defensive positions. 2, we are not, as yet, within close enough striking distance to the island of Japan itself. 3, despite the long drain of the war in China, Japan still has 2 million men who could be equipped and trained to fight without affecting her war production. So you see, our job of keeping wartime regulations, buying bonds, and producing war material is as vital as ever. And now here's James Stevenson and your World News Roundup.
Although the Russian advance through Silesia rolls right along, the spearheads have not yet reached the main German fortifications, which the Nazis are believed to have built west of the Oder River. The first real test is yet to come, and it remains to be seen whether Hitler's boasts of an impregnable east wall similar to the Siegfried Line in the west were mere words or fact. In the meantime, both authentic and unconfirmed reports indicate the German morale has reached a dangerously low point, and the Nazis may be facing an internal situation which might be more explosive than even Russia's great guns. Today's story from Sweden, claiming that Nazi leaders are leaving Berlin for safer territory, also says that the rest of the population will be evacuated as soon as the party officials have escaped. As I said before, this story is totally unconfirmed and reached Sweden through devious and roundabout routes. But there can be no question that the German people now realize their grave situation, for even the Nazi radio makes no attempt to conceal the fear and alarm of Germany's leaders. The Germans have never had to fight a great war on their own soil. From the time Bismarck molded the Reich out of the numerous Germanic states and united the Teutonic peoples into one warlike nation, Germany had carried the fight to other countries and fought her wars on their lands. German cities and farms had never experienced the awful destruction which had so often been visited upon Belgium, Holland, France, and the Balkans. And despite the Allied air attacks, which gave the Germans a taste of their own medicine, the German people believed their Nazi leaders, who told them time and again that the Holy Fatherland would never feel the weight of an enemy's foot. And so now, when Russian troops, tanks, and heavy guns approach, it is probable that the German people are losing faith in their leaders and are becoming panic-stricken. And their fear is all the greater because they were told that the Russians were inhuman beasts who should be cruelly destroyed. That was the Nazi propaganda line when Germany invaded Russia. The German people remember the Nazi propaganda, which sent them on what they believed to be a holy crusade against helpless old men, women, and children. They remember that they were told the Russians must be destroyed to save the fatherland, and they participated in the greatest mass murder in the history of the world. And now, it is these same Russians who threatened to overwhelm the Reich. The same Russians who saw their cities and towns destroyed by a fanatic and vicious Nazi, who gave no quarter and killed without mercy. And the German people, who gave their support to the destruction of Russia, are now faced with retribution. The foot of the enemy lies near the Reich. The holy soil of Germany will soon feel the weight of justice. And now comes the supreme test as to whether the German, for the first time, can meet adversity with the same courage he showed as a conqueror. The first reports indicate that he is losing his nerve. It remains to be seen. And now we're ready for our first report from overseas, and for that, we go by shortwave to NBC in the Pacific.
Thank you. This is Pat Flaherty on Luzon in the Philippines. Around 5 o'clock this morning, I was awakened by the piercing sound of machine gun fire about 2 miles away. Right after breakfast, I talked with PFC Clifford Johnson of Fort Payne, Alabama, who made a Jeep Courier run of 77 miles to the south yesterday. That's the way this campaign on Luzon is going. The war is 77 miles away to the south in the central section, while to the northeast, it's as close as 2 miles. There is hardly tokens of resistance in front of the crushing drives of the 37th and 40th Divisions of the 14th Corps moving toward Manila. However, in the mountain area on the left flank, covered by the 1st or I Corps with the 6th, 25th, and 43rd Divisions and the 158th Regimental Combat Team in action, stiff skirmishes and artillery duels are taking place. In these mountain positions, the Japs are a confident lot, with their confidence based on their equipment, number of troops, and supplies, rather than what they are accomplishing in a tactical way. For example, 3 men, American patrols, have been fired upon point blank by Jap 75mm guns as the men sought out the Jap positions. Evidently, the Nips have plenty of ammunition. The Japs have commanding positions in this mountainous terrain, but they are constantly moving to alternate positions, hoping to escape the accurate fire of the Corps artillery units. Thus, while the spotlight is on the 14th Corps divisions driving down the Luzon Plains to Manila, measuring their gains in amazing miles, the 1st Corps divisions on the left flank are encountering stubborn enemy resistance and, for the present, measuring their gains in yards. The Japs tied up 7 of our divisions on Leyte. They traded more than 120,000 lives, feeling they were engaging our maximum strength. 5 new divisions and a regimental combat team are on their necks now, and far from consoling must be the fact that those 7 divisions in Leyte are now available for further orders from General MacArthur. I return you to NBC in New York.
From the Pacific, we now go to Europe for a first-hand report from NBC's Ed Hocker. Come in, NBC in London.
This is Ed Hocker in London. The barometer is falling over the Straits of Dover this morning. It's bitterly cold and the sky is overcast with snow clouds. But again, mingled with those clouds are the hundreds of long vapor trails left by the heavy bombers of the 8th Air Force. And they're pointing those vapor trails, as usual, directly toward Germany. Once more, that guttural Teutonic voice, somber and colorless, has boomed forth its radio warning to the Reich. Achtung, Achtung. Allied planes are over Germany. We still don't know the specific targets of the day's operations, but we do know that during the night, strong forces of the RAF were out, that concentrated attacks were made on the Bruckhausen Benzol plant near Duisburg, that the industrial and communication center of Gelsenkirchen was plastered as well, that 2 of the British aircraft failed to return. On the domestic side of the British news today, the nation is enmeshed in a highly controversial argument over a plan for coal, released by a Mr. Robert Foote, who is chairman of Britain's Mining Association. The British are distressed over what is termed the startling contrast between British and American practice in the coal fields. They've been told that the American miner produces an average of 30 tons of coal a week, the British miner 5 or 6. Thus, there is general agreement that reforms must be carried out in the collieries, but how is the question? Mr. Foote's plan calls for a central board which would have power to impose its decisions on the mine owners, the owners in turn to maintain control of the mines. Private ownership, that is. But with the usual British candor, and it's sometimes surprising to Americans, even some of the conservative comment is taking the angle that nothing short of public ownership of the mines will ever satisfy the miners themselves, that the country should no longer entrust such a vital industry as the coal industry to men who have allowed it to become so disorganized. Turning to the diplomatic side of the news, Britain expects Warsaw shortly to be proclaimed capital of the liberated Poland. As for King Peter and his plan to dismiss Premier Subasic of Yugoslavia, the best comment of the day is that his folly would be incredible if it were not a fact. And here's a brief item. The Rosenbach Company of Philadelphia has just bought the Benjamin Franklin letters here in London. The purchase price, $21,600. This is Ed Hawker in London, now switching you to NBC in Washington.
And this is Leif Eade in Washington. And this morning, with conservative Southern Democrats and Republicans still smoldering over the Henry Wallace appointment, some of the strategies his enemies may use against Wallace is beginning to show itself. First, there's a George bill that would strip away the vast government lending machinery from the Department of Commerce, make two jobs of the one Jesse Jones has held. If that were done, most of Wallace's enemies wouldn't raise any big objection to his becoming Secretary of Commerce. They don't think the Commerce job amounts to much anyway, that it wouldn't give Wallace much of a chance to build himself up as a presidential candidate in 1948. Then there's some talk that the Commerce Committee would report out the bill and yet hold up Wallace's nomination until the bill became law. And there's a suggestion this morning that Mr. Roosevelt's putting Henry Wallace pretty much on his own. Wallace took his beating at the Chicago Convention without a whimper. The president's giving him the chance he's asked for. But the White House may feel that if Wallace can't get by the Senate, well, that's just too bad. Republican Senator Taft seems to think the president is making this move to get rid of both Wallace and Jones. Jones, of course, for party disloyalty. Otherwise, organized labor is bracing itself to fight the May work or else bill. It sees the beginning of an anti-union drive in the clause that says no drafted worker assigned to a closed shop would be required to join a union. On the other side of the manpower situation, the Navy is nettled by Senator Meade's charges of excess manpower, wasted labor, hoarded labor, and enforced loafing at the Norfolk Navy Yard. Meade says the armed forces must clean their houses, not only in their arsenals and navy yards, but also in their actual uniformed ranks. And today, OPA and WPB chiefs meet with clothing manufacturers. The industry men expect bad news on the handling of shortages and prices in children's clothes, men's shirts, and low-priced dresses for women. Eade in Washington, returning you now to New York.
And this morning, we heard from NBC observers Pat Flaherty, speaking from Luzon in the Philippines, Ed Hawker in London, and Leif Eade in Washington. Now here's your announcer, and then I'll be back with more news.
Suppose that someone gave you $1,000, and suppose that you had no other money and no means of getting any more. What would you do? Would you spend it all at once, or would you try to make it last just as long as possible? Well, of course you'd try to make it last. But what are you doing about your car? Are you using it so that it will last? You know, your tires and your car itself are going to have to serve you and your family a lot longer than in normal peacetimes. And no one knows just how long it will be before new tires and new cars will be available to everyone. Now, if you use your car to go to work every day, it's not going to last very long. Yet you may say that you have to go to work by car. Well, how about forming a carpool with some of your fellow workers? That way you take turns with your cars, and the life of each car and each set of tires is lengthened considerably. How about speaking to your friends about it? Remember, your car may have to last you a long, long time. So form a carpool with your fellow workers. And again, here's James Stevenson in the NBC newsroom.
A Western Front bulletin reports that United States 1st Army tank patrols today smashed into the outskirts of Saint-Vie, the last German stronghold in the collapsing Ardennes salient, following air attacks yesterday which turned the enemy withdrawal into a rout. Guatemala suspended diplomatic relations with the Franco regime in Spain last night on the ground that maneuvers of the Spanish phalangists constitute a threat to American continental security. The first convoy of trucks to carry war supplies to China in 2.5 years is ready today to move over the new Lado Road, which was declared officially open to military traffic. And Jap Premier Koiso was quoted by the Dome News Agency today as saying the morale of Japanese forces on Luzon is at a high pitch, with the troops having every confidence in their preparedness. The enemy, he said, already seems to show signs of wavering. He did not reveal what signs he referred to. And that's the morning's news from around the world. This is James Stevenson in the NBC newsroom in New York, saying goodbye, and I'll be seeing you tomorrow morning.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.
Good evening, everyone. This is John W. Vanderkirk speaking for Alka-Seltzer, bringing you the news of the world. At least three of the giant Russian armies are continuing their unparalleled rate of advance of approximately 30 miles a day. The Red Scissors have all but snipped East Prussia from the rest of Germany. In the west, U.S. troops have taken the town of Saint-Vith after an all-day fight with the German rearguard. The British have pushed 2 miles deeper into Germany. Two U.S. divisions on Luzon are tonight only 11 miles from Clark Airfield. And now, a word from Charles Lyon.
The job of every one of us here on the home front is to keep on the job. And to do good work, it is important to feel like doing it. Now, since the B-complex vitamins, among other things, can have so much to do with the way you feel, especially where normal energy, nerves, and digestion are concerned, it can very well pay everyone to make sure, at least, of the B-complex vitamins. Now, to do this, thousands of people are fortifying the food they eat with one-a-day brand vitamin B-complex tablets. Each one-a-day brand B-complex tablet provides a full basic daily amount of the B vitamins for which requirements have been established. So this means you simply take one tablet every day. Now, besides making one-a-day vitamin B-complex easy to remember, this single tablet a day convenience proves most economical as well. Yes, if you want to be sure of your B vitamins, sure you're getting enough to help maintain normal energy, nerves, and digestion these busy days, take a single one-a-day B-complex tablet every day. Tell your druggist you want one-a-day brand vitamin B-complex tablets made by the makers of Alka-Seltzer. Look for the big one on the gray package. Now back to John W. Vanderkook.
The Russian offensive in the east is entering its second stage. The stage of decision, of what may be the final decision of the war. To repeat once more the hackneyed phrase, the Germans have traded space for time and manpower. Now they have no more space to trade. The Red Army has reached the upper courses of the Oder River below Breslau along a 37-mile front. The incredibly swift drive of Marshal Rokossovsky's armies through the minefields, tank ditches, and defenses of the southern half of the province of East Prussia have carried the red flag to within only 22 miles of the Baltic Sea coast. Or, if the current Soviet timetable should be kept, less than another day's journey. When those red troops reach that northern sea coast, East Prussia will become, for all practical purposes, a rear area. No one, except Adolf Hitler, has ever questioned the patriotic Germanism of the Prussian officer caste. At the same time, those men were the brains and strength of the German army. Are practical and property-minded men. The dismal forests and the still more dismal clay and sand potato fields of that region have for a long time provided those professional soldiers with the income that has enabled them to think of themselves as aristocrats and to devote their lives to the trade of war. The Nazis, who've always been suspicious of them, may suspect the news their ancestral estates are being overrun by Russian communists may have diminished still further their will to continue with a useless war. Berlin reports that the active boss of Germany, Gestapo chief Heinrich Himmler, has gone with a large staff of his henchmen to take full charge of Eastern Front operations. The loss of some personal real estate would in itself not make the Prussian officers stop fighting. But for a long time, two points of view have been in sharp conflict inside Germany. The old line Wehrmacht officers are professionals. They are also, in a sense, mystics. Their first aim is victory. When victory becomes impossible, they then begin to think as they always have thought, in terms of their country's future as a military power. The Prussians have practiced war for generations. They can scarcely imagine a world in which their sons and grandsons will not go on waging other wars for generations to come. Their point of view, and it was behind the abortive General's Rebellion against Hitler in July, is therefore always colored by a consideration for preserving from final destruction as much as possible of German manpower. So a foundation will be left for the creation of future armies. The Nazis, Himmler himself is the perfect example, indulge in no such long-range thinking. They have no future. They, unlike the German Wehrmacht generals, most of whom will probably survive, look forward to nothing but a final dance upon the empty air at a rope's end. It's therefore significant, to say the least, that the most diabolically typical Nazi of them all, Himmler, has today felt it necessary to take into his own hands the overall command of Germany's eastern defenses. Himmler gets results. The huge organism, sensitive to his command, is trained, quite simply, to kill without hesitation if every order is not instantly obeyed. Every German officer, soldier, and civilian is aware of it. One can therefore confidently expect the German lines to stiffen. Soon, great battles will be fought. If the Russians can win them, they will be the last great battles of the war. I switch you now across the Atlantic to NBC in London.
This is John McVane in London. American forces in the salient have cleaned up the important communications point of St. Vit and gone beyond it. Gains of 1 to 4 miles are reported along the northern part of the salient. Down south, the American 7th Army has announced a withdrawal to new positions in the bend of the front north of Strasbourg. The Americans pulled out 3 days ago in a snowstorm, but kept quiet about it until the Germans found out for themselves. The Germans are claiming Russia now. Even if true to the German public tonight, their success will shine about as brightly as a match flame in a raging forest fire. The fact that both Mr. Churchill and Mr. Eden were received by the King today has brought rumors that the meeting with President Roosevelt and Marshal Stalin is imminent. A more probable reason is that any British government decision affecting the position of King Peter of Yugoslavia, a relative of the British king, would, out of courtesy, be discussed fully at Buckingham Palace. It looks probable tonight that General de Gaulle will represent France at the big conference. There's a tendency recently in high allied circles to refer to the big four instead of the big three. It's realized that without France, plans affecting Europe and the Mediterranean could be only tentative. Perhaps the clinching factor is that the most important topic at the meeting will be what to do with Germany. And when you get to talking about demilitarizing the Ruhr and the Rhineland, perhaps separating them from Germany and running them by some international body, it's French military power that must keep them from ever again being used for war. Some observers here think that at this next conference, America will show a more forceful attitude toward foreign affairs than in the past. The idea of spheres of influence hasn't been a real success and may be discarded. If the four chief allies can get together and frame real joint international policies, no question is too difficult to solve. But some skilled observers believe that trying to mark off areas in which we aren't interested will lead straight to isolationism and future crises of international anarchy. This is John McVane in London, returning you to the NBC newsroom in New York.
And next, we journey westward for a direct report from Mid-Pacific. Go ahead, NBC in the Pacific.
This is Bud Foster speaking from United States Pacific Fleet Headquarters at Pearl Harbor. A very brief communique signed by Admiral Nimitz announced this morning what has been the subject of Jap radio broadcast for the past 3 days. A strong force of carrier-borne aircraft has attacked the Jap stronghold of Okinawa Jima in the Aryukyu Islands, 350 miles south of the Japanese home island of Kyushu. Due to the necessity of maintaining radio silence until the force has cleared the area, reports of the damage inflicted are not yet available. There is a distinct possibility the attacks are continuing. Meanwhile, the publicly expressed worried frame of mind of the Japanese government, who now claim more strongly than ever that their nation is in dire peril, and have even gone so far as to anticipate an American invasion of the home island, lends still further credence to the general belief that this may be the year for the Pacific War. As we have often stated, the tempo of attack from the Philippines to the northern Kuriles has been stepped up to an unbelievable pitch, with American forces roaring ahead toward Manila as the carriers block the Japs at most every turn. Throughout the entire Pacific area, other American forces gather for new blows that may come at any time. And the beauty of any new blows, if there is such a thing as beauty where warfare is concerned, is that each step from now on falls on pre-war Japanese soil, whereas heretofore, every move, with the exception of our drive into the Marianas, has been the process of retaking what rightfully belonged to the Allied nations. The war soon will be fought on Japanese soil, with Japanese, other than military or naval personnel, feeling the pain and suffering their military has inflicted on innocent peoples in these 3 years of war. Combined with the enemy government's inner crises, America's 1945 drive, if kept up to its present pace, may bring a comparatively early victory. We take you now to NBC in Washington.
This is Morgan Beatty in Ernst Capital. The anti-Wallace forces came through today as advertised. The Senate Commerce Committee voted 10-2 to bypass the nomination of the former vice president to the cabinet. Then the committee took up the George Bill, the measure to strip out the vast lending powers of the Commerce Department, now under the wing of Jesse Jones, and make them an independent function. Hearings on the George Bill will begin at 10:30 a.m. tomorrow against the vigorous protests of Senator Pepper of Florida, a Wallace man. This is another way of undercutting the president and glorifying Jesse Jones, said Mr. Pepper, as if he were the only man in the world qualified to hold the place. But the anti-Wallace men carried the day strategically, and they have every intention, if they can, of pigeonholing the Wallace appointment and keeping it in a pigeonhole until the Commerce Department has been cut down from a financial giant to a midget. Then they'll be willing to confirm Henry Wallace. Still, the wise men on Capitol Hill are not betting their chips yet, either way. 7 members of Senator Bailey's Commerce Committee were absent today, 7 out of 19. Wallace backers tonight are casting around for a quick showdown, but so far, all they can do is run around in ineffective circles. Meanwhile, Senator Bailey has invited the political gladiators to appear before the committee, the Commerce Committee, on the question of separating Commerce and the RFC. Jesse Jones is the first witness on the list, not by accident, you may be sure. He'll appear tomorrow morning. Mr. Wallace has been asked to testify the next day, and he hasn't answered as yet. The Republicans in the House decided to take advantage of this internal Democratic row. That perennial New Deal baiter, Representative Hoffman of Michigan, wanted to know whether the Wallace appointment was a violation against the laws barring political jobs for political favors. And Representative Gifford of Massachusetts pretended to feel very sorry for the Democrats. The election was bought by promises, he said. You won, but you had the legions of Earl Browder with you. I am sorry for you, not for us. On the Senate side of the Capitol, Republican Senator Bridges prodded the military committee into an investigation of Colonel Elliot Roosevelt's high-flying dog, Blaze, the dog who bumped 2 servicemen off an army plane. The investigation will include, said Senator Stewart, the sub-chairman, both dogs and men and priorities. But over in the State Department, business affecting the lives of millions of people in this and the next generation was afoot. That is, the coming Congress of the heads of government of Russia, Great Britain, and the United States. Acting Secretary of State Joseph Grew pointedly reminded Chiang Kai-shek's China that an agreement with the northern Chinese communists is practically essential to speed the victory in the Far East. And once again, he put the United States on record as favoring representation for all factions in the liberated governments of Europe. He referred particularly to Yugoslavia. At the same time, the House Naval Affairs Committee decided to study American defense needs in the Pacific, including bases much farther west than Pearl Harbor. The cost and the value of fortifying those bases will come up for discussion. And Chairman Bloom of the House Foreign Affairs Committee decided to make another try to get the voice of the House into the developing world discussion of things to come. As if the president had already bought a world peace organization and brought it back to Washington, Mr. Bloom said the seat of the future organization should be in the Western Hemisphere. And that's what happened in Washington today.
John W. Vandercook will return with some more late news. Friends, if that job today has left you feeling upset with a touch of acid indigestion, try this for prompt, pleasant relief. Be wise. Alkalize with Alka-Seltzer. You see, Alka-Seltzer can be just the thing for occasional acid indigestion, for it not only offers relief from that upset, jittery feeling in the stomach, but it also actually helps reduce excess gastric acidity. Make it a point to keep Alka-Seltzer handy always. Then, when a touch of acid indigestion causes you trouble, be wise. Alkalize with Alka-Seltzer. Now, back to the NBC newsroom.
Rome. To everyone's complete amazement, the Germans have chosen this unlikely moment to reinforce their armies on the Italian front by at least 1 fresh division. The inference is the redoubtable Marshal von Kesselring must be planning some kind of counteroffensive. On the front, the Germans, at least, have never forgotten. Currently, the extremely international Allied 5th and 8th Armies and the 28 Nazi divisions now facing them are confining their activities to exploratory patrol expeditions in the deep snows and bitter cold of the high Apennines. Aerial missions have been carried out by both sides in relatively small strength and today without conspicuous results. And that's the news of the world. This is John W. Vandercook speaking for Alka-Seltzer. Until tomorrow evening at this same time, goodbye from the NBC newsroom in New York.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.